The film takes a position that is somewhat ambiguous, because for me, I think it's a lot more important for the audience to watch the film and start the conversation surrounding the issue. I didn't want it to be too preachy in any particular direction, because I think in a society like Singapore, and also in many societies around the world where the death penalty is still being practiced, it's an issue that is sort of out of sight, out of mind. And I think to get people to start contemplating it and thinking deeper about its implications, we need to provide points of entry that allow that to happen.
Festival. This is a special edition of The Cinema Show, coming to you from the 69th Cannes Film Festival. The voice you heard there was director Bu Jun Feng. He'll join me soon to discuss his film playing in the Uncertain Regard section this year. Also ahead,
it's always under pressure, and that's the best way to make a good selection, you know, to be limited by the power of the official selection make us more at ease.
Renowned Swiss critic Edouard Weintraub discusses his fifth year in charge of the directors of Fortnite Plus.
We spent quite a lot of time as well looking for the cast. So we were going to places looking for lots of young people. So I guess I was immersed in that world, in the young world, if you like.
Andrea Arnold, Jeff Nichols, Pedro Almodovar. Who'll take away this year's Palme d'Or? That's all to come on this special edition of The Cinema Show at the Cannes Film Festival on Monocle 24. Hello from the Palais du Festival, the beating heart of this illustrious event. The film world has been flocking to this waterfront city perched upon the French Riviera since the 1930s. But it wasn't actually until 1955 that the festival's highest honour, the Palme d'Or, was created, the design of which is actually intended as a tribute to the city's coat of arms. The contenders for this year's award are enormously varied, from the desolate, moody drama of Andrea Arnold's American Honey to the timely tale of interracial marriage in 1950s Virginia with Loving by director Jeff Nichols. Let's take a look at some of the top favourites. If you want to know the official line on what's happening at Cannes, read the daily trade papers, Variety or The Hollywood Reporter. But if you really want the inside word, a little eavesdropping whilst waiting in line for screenings is your best bet. And if Red Carpet Whispers decided the winner of the Palme d'Or, Marin Arde might indeed have already taken the prize with her third film, Tony Erdmann.
I'm Tony Erdmann. I'm consultant and coach.
Wow.
Also, ich habe zum Beispiel von meinem Vater gelernt, wie man eine Käsereibe benutzt.
Hm. Ist das eine spezielle Käsereibe?
The German writer-director's achievement is impressive, but close on her tail is Andrea Arnold. Now, she's won the jury prize twice before, and her entrant this year is the wondrous middle American wasteland drama, American Honey. Alongside the cast at the press conference here, Arnold spoke of her experiences visiting some of the economically depressed locations as seen in the film.
It seemed really different to me than in the UK, you know, because when people don't have money, they can't get healthcare and they can't get, you know, do things like go to the dentist and stuff like that. And those kind of things really shocked me. There was a time when we were, and the drugs as well, that was another thing that I found really interesting, is that everywhere we went, especially I guess we were looking for, we spent quite a lot of time as well looking for the cast. So we were going to places looking for lots of young people. So I guess I was immersed in that world, in the young world, if you like. But there was one time we were in West Virginia in a tiny town, and this town had like a drugstore. It had a dollar store, a funeral director's, which was flourishing, and about three drugstores, pharmacies, in a tiny, tiny town. And I thought, wow, three pharmacies in a tiny town, that's really interesting. And then we went into one pharmacy, and in one pharmacy, there were like five people behind the counter doing prescriptions. And I found that I don't know, in the UK you go into Boots and there's like one guy behind there, you know, doing the prescription. So I found that quite interesting. I asked them what were they, you know, dishing out, and they said they were dishing out painkillers to older people and antidepressants to young people. And it was a tiny, tiny town. And they said there was a lot of addiction to both those things in that town.
Spanish writer-director Pedro Almodóvar may indeed be an accomplished auteur, but he's something of an underdog here this year. His film, Julieta, plays like the melodramatic grandchild of a 1980s telenovela. Even if he misses out on the top honour, his film is undoubtedly a popular highlight.
Querida Antía, voy a contarte todo lo que no tuve ocasión de contarte. Porque eras una niña. Porque me resultaba demasiado doloroso. O por simple pudor.
Writer-director Jeff Nichols impressed with his low-key science fiction drama Midnight Special a few months ago. His film here is titled Loving, telling the true story of an interracial couple who fell foul of the law in 1958 Virginia.
I want to put the kitchen back, right back here.
Richard, stop this. I don't know what you're saying.
I bought it. This whole acre. I'm going to build you a house. Right here.
There's even talk of Loving being an early Oscars contender. Maybe so. But while the praise here has been admiring, it's not the kind of enthusiasm that really wins the night. The film does, however, feature some amazing performances. Joel Edgerton is particularly impressive. Speaking at the press conference here, he explained the importance of subtlety in his performance and in telling the story.
This movie was very special, and it was very special because of how quiet and meditative and simple things were. And I think the guide to it was the truth. The guide of the film was what really happened, and it's there. The information is there. We had access to footage of the couple and family members. Jeff had constructed a screenplay that was about the small building blocks of the truth that led to an accumulative effect that I think is at the same time triumphant and very shameful, you know, that you celebrate something, some struggle that shouldn't have had to exist.
The Palme d'Or is awarded this Sunday. A weekend is a long time in Cannes, however. There's plenty of time for the tide to change. Back in 2010, Bu Jun Feng became the first filmmaker from Singapore to have their film invited to be screened at International Critics Week here in Cannes. He's back this year with his second feature, Apprentice, an affecting look at Singapore's somewhat troubling relationship with capital punishment.
Have you been here before?
No, sir.
We're a maximum security prison. You'll be handling rehab prisoners. But here we also have punishment cells. And death row cells.
Bu Junfeng joins me now. Thanks for being here. I suspect even those who have visited Singapore may be unaware of how harsh the death penalty laws are. Some have described your film as an indictment on the laws. Is that something you were setting out to say with this film?
Well, the film takes a position that is somewhat ambiguous, because for me, I think it's a lot more important for the audience to watch the film and start the conversation surrounding the issue. I didn't want it to be too preachy in any particular direction, because I think in a society like Singapore, and also in many societies around the world where the death penalty is still being practiced, it's an issue that is sort of out of sight, out of mind. And I think to get people to start contemplating it and thinking deeper about its implications, we need to provide points of entry that allow that to happen.
So was that difficult for you to navigate then? Because I would imagine that you would have many of your own thoughts and your own ideas of where you sit on the issue of capital punishment. Were you aware of not letting your own moral values seep too far into your film?
Yes, well, I'm against the death penalty because I don't believe society or the state has the right to take the life of any individual. But I always sort of reiterate that that's not what the film is about. I think over the course of the past 5 years, writing, researching, and directing the film, my position has been challenged several times before. And for instance, when I first got to meet one of the hangmen that I interviewed, I went in there trying to be as open-minded as I could because I didn't want to sort of judge the person before I've even met or spoken to him. But 5 minutes into the conversation, I forgot he was the hangman because he was such a lovable, grandfatherly, jocular character that I couldn't believe how much I actually liked him as a person. And I was there with his family and I got a better understanding of what life was like. And that completely threw me off. And for 3 months, I couldn't write because I realized the character that I had in mind at that time was really just a caricature. I wanted to understand the human psyche behind it. And in doing that, I needed to humanize this person and how he could bring himself to execute people over and over again.
So it strikes me that your film really takes place surrounding the burgeoning friendship between two people. What was the inspiration behind you choosing to communicate your message via the portrayal of these two people?
Well, I wanted to approach this subject matter from a different point of view. I felt that films that deal with the death penalty have been made before many times from the prisoner's point of view. And I was very curious about the perspective of the executioner because this was a person who actually needed to kill someone and is empowered by the state to kill people. So I wanted to explore what that was about, and even more so, someone who is new, like Ayman, the protagonist, who has to sort of ascend into the job, and what kinds of moral and ethical dilemmas that someone like that would go through. So I was very curious about this point of view, and therefore I embarked on this journey, researching about it and writing about it, and in order to explore the human psyche behind it.
And Junfeng, just finally, how have you found Cannes this year? What's the reception been like, and how are you finding the whole atmosphere surrounding your time there so far?
Well, it's been wonderful. We've had the fortune of flying up my three of the lead actors, and a lot of the lead crew were here as well. And because it's a five-country co-production, and so it involved many, many partners from around the world, and I was very, very pleased that they could all be here with me to share the moment. My actors and myself, we've also been approached on the streets very often, and people have been telling us how affected they were by the film, and that's meant a lot to us, and it's been a wonderful experience for us.
The Palais du Festival may be the heart of Cannes at this time of year, but even its 25,000 square metre space can't contain all the distributors, production companies, funding bodies, and hopeful young filmmakers that flock here year after year. Wandering down the Boulevard de la Croisette can be a somewhat difficult task. You first need to make it through all the curious onlookers buzzing around the Palais' main entrance. What once would have been the front gardens of the city's prime waterfront apartments and townhouses are now scattered with luxury boutiques Gucci, Prada, Cartier, Valentino. At this time of year, their doorsteps are almost as busy as the Grand Theatre Lumiere. Just a few doors down is Le Malmaison, a beautiful old former hotel that now serves as an art gallery and as the office of the renowned Swiss critic Edouard Weintraub. He's celebrating his fifth year at the helm of the Director's Fortnight, a somewhat unofficial yet very prestigious sideshow to the main section.
It was the incarnation, we can say, about the events of May 68 in Cannes. I don't know if you remember, because it's a long time ago. In 68, the festival was cancelled because of the general strike in France at that moment. But the directors were there, and they met themselves. They made a great agora, and they decided to create a new section, which will be under the responsibility of the new union they were creating at that moment, the SRF, Société des Réalisateurs de Films. And so in 69, it was the first Director's Fortnight. The artistic director at that time was Pierre-Henri Delot, and he stayed 30 years at the head of the Director's Fortnight. And so it's an old institution, but born after a great convulsion in France. We like the way we are working here, because it's always under pressure, and that's the best way to make a good selection, you know, to be limited by the power of the official selection, make us more at ease, and because we have to make some other choices, and sometimes it's there are choices we didn't think about 2 weeks before, 1 week before, 1 hour before. So it's something very exciting to be the opposition and to be seen as rebels, even we are not rebels at all.
Rebels after quality. You have called it the most open of all the sections at the festival. Why is that?
First, because we have not the obligation, for example, that the Critics' Week is obliged to follow some rules, to take only first and second movies. We can take movies from a complete beginner, as a movie by Paul Schrader of Marco Bellocchio. We are completely free on this level. We are also free because we can make the choices we want. You know, the problem of the general selection is they miss an important movie director. They will be pursued. They will be prosecuted by the press. We are only judged by the press on what we are showing, not on what we are not showing. So it's easier. I know that the business of the official competition is really much harder than ours. But we have some limitations. The limitations are that if a very good movie is appearing and the competition is aware about the quality of the movie, it's going directly to the competition. Sometimes it happens. But that's the only limitation we have, and that's a limitation I accept very easily. That makes us to be more first aware about the relativity of the success, and secondly more aware also about the necessity of being creative every year.
More from that interview with Edouard Weintraub next week. Still to come today, we will head down to the International Village and explore the Marché du Film with a couple of South African filmmakers. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. You can try a whole month of MUBI for free right now. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That is MUBI/monocle. Back in a moment.
How would you fix London? Which challenge would you tackle first, from housing to transport, businesses and even the nighttime economy? As a new mayor settles in at City Hall, we hand the floor to a panel of experts and ask how to build a better London. Join us on the 2nd of June for a special edition of The Urbanist, live from Midori House and hosted by our editor Andrew Tuck. Get your ticket today at monocle.com.
V. This is a special edition of The Cinema Show, coming to you from the 69th Cannes Film Festival. And while much of the press might have us believe that this event is all about who said what on the red carpet, it is at its heart an industry show, a trade fair of epic proportions. Le Marché du Film has been held alongside the main event since 1959, attracting about 12,000 filmmakers hungry to lock in a lucrative distribution deal. Venturing down to the Village International on the waterfront, I spoke to South African filmmakers Shane Vermouten and Brett Michael Innes.
When you walk into the main hall and you find out there's 6,000 other films here, you realize, wow, I'm a very small fish in a very large pond. I think getting here, you feel amazing. Yes, I'm in Cannes, there's a red carpet, I've made a film. And you walk in, you realize, wow, this is a zoo. And so it has been amazing. I think a lot of it entails setting up meetings beforehand. So probably about 50, 60% of our meetings we had set up beforehand. And the remainder of them is just walking around, meeting people at parties, meeting people at their booth, and basically pitching yourself over and over and over again. We've had about 40 meetings now in 4 days. So it's been crazy, but it's been fun.
So obviously it is a daunting process as well, but have you found it quite rewarding?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, every day you go home and your feet are broken and your knees are sore and feels like your back is about to explode. I think then you know, wow, I've had a good day. And everything's tired, your brain is tired. But it is definitely a very rewarding process, especially, I mean, in our case, we had a finished screener, so a lot of people had seen it before we met with them. But if someone hasn't seen your film and, you know, they're seeing thousands and thousands of people and you manage to just with one line get them interested and then get them to bite a bit further and then show them a trailer and then show them a scene from your film. And with every bite, it's like, yes, they're getting interesting. I think that's a very rewarding process. And every time you pitch, you go, okay, next time I'm going to say this differently. And so it's been very fun sort of refining the pitch and getting people more and more interested every time we pitch.
We're standing outside the South African pavilion here at Cannes. It does strike me that some nations here must have an easier time selling their product than countries like South Africa, which doesn't have the biggest presence on the international film market. Do you find that there is an extra hurdle or an extra few hurdles that you need to jump through merely because you're coming from the South African market?
I think coming from the South African market can sometimes be a hurdle, and then at other times it can be a positive thing. For example, in the last few years we've had a few big films come out of South Africa, a few directors who have really gone on and made it both in the indie scene and in the Hollywood scene, and I think that's really helped South Africa. A lot of times I've asked the question to people, hey, should I go over to the States and go work there? And a lot of people said, rather stay in South Africa because Hollywood and the world is looking to South Africa because they know there's talent there and they know they can make films a lot cheaper than you could make it anywhere else. And so just stay telling good solid stories in South Africa because the world is looking there. But again, well, we've got the benefit of that, the world looking there, and we can do things cheaply. Funding in South Africa for film is a very difficult thing, specifically if you're looking for funding within South Africa. There are many avenues, and the government gives probably a lot more money than a lot of other countries give to film, but there's lots of people basically scrapping for the same money. So I think it has its pros and its cons, like any country, but I would say the biggest one is definitely financing, especially when you've got so many other issues where, in some sense, to people, cinema seems like irrelevant. Like, when we've got so many other problems, why should we set money aside for cinema? And so it's basically working on changing that mindset about the power of cinema in South Africa.
So tell me about the process that you had to go through to get your film financed then. Did you find it difficult?
I was amazingly lucky, actually. The process for getting our film financed was completely different. We got financed by the National Lottery in our country. And unlike a lot of other countries, the National Lottery doesn't often fund films. But we structured our film in such a way that we had learnership. So we had kids who had been doing film training and now needed on-job training. So we had all the senior positions knew what they were doing, and then we brought students in and trained them almost on the job. And that way, we got a lot of funding from our National Lottery. And then the remainder, our executive producer put in. So what is also amazing with the money is that the money that was given, by the time we received it, expired in 1 year. So we could have probably used an extra 50,000, 100,000, 150,000 pounds to make the film. But the fact of the matter was the money we received is expiring in 1 year. So by the time we got that money, we needed to get off our butts and make a film. And so I think I would probably still be here today speaking about pitching my film and raising funds, but we just needed to make a film. And so while it was a curse, I think looking back, it was an amazing blessing because it kicked our butts into gear to make a movie.
And so just finally then, after being here at the festival this year, tell me about how you'll be walking away from the event. Are you feeling optimistic and hopeful about how things have gone for you?
First of all, I'll be absolutely broken. I'll try not to walk for a week. But yes, I'm super hopeful, optimistic. Like I said, we've probably had about 40 meetings and we're going to probably go home with about 10 contracts of people ready to sign our film. And so I suppose the process back home is we'll just go down the list, our highest to our lowest, and then whoever offers, we will look at the pros and cons and we will draft an agreement. So I'm really excited going forward for the film. But I think more than that, coming to Cannes for the first time with my first film, it's every day you just learn so much. You learn about how to negotiate a contract, what distributors maybe telling the truth and which ones not, even how to bring distributors on while you're still writing a film. Every day I just realize, wow, I've made a film, but it's again comes back to the more you know, the more you realize it's actually the less you know.
My name is Brett Michael Innes. I'm a writer-director and I've come to the Cannes Film Festival with my first project, Sync, to meet with buyers. We've done pretty well in the South African territories and we wanted to see how it travels, and I guess I'm also here just to see what this machine of Cannes looks like, how it operates, where I fit into it.
Now, you do come from a relatively small film community, South Africa. South Africa certainly does have a film culture, but I suppose bringing your experience to Cannes must be quite a culture shock.
There is a culture shock here. I think there's the language barrier, and also I've watched quite a few films in the festival, and it's so interesting to see how different audiences respond to films that don't do anything for me, and when a movie does something for me, how it doesn't do something for someone else, and recognizing where your stories and what you're trying to do fits into all of that. So that culture shock's definitely there, but on the other hand, I recognize so many of the things that exist in the tiny little South African ecosystem of film. The connections that you make, the way some of this plays out and works. What I love is you kind of think that it either gets easier or that it's completely different, the struggles that people have on the international stage, but it's just, I think it's all the same. You always, not enough budget, there's not enough time, not enough buyers, and then something happens and your film gets picked up. Yeah, so I think there's that dual thing of a culture shock and then also recognizing all the things that I've seen.
So what are your hopes for the culture back at home then? Do you have any ideas for where you'd like to see South African film heading?
On a creative level, I'd really love to see South Africans tell stories that resonate universally, that resonate with the global audience, but also that experiment and push the bar as far as genre goes, as far as execution goes. I think we've played it quite safe because we're trying to make returns in our own country. And often a lot of our films end up being copy-paste of an American film or a British film. And it's been quite exciting for me to see this next generation of SA filmmakers actually pushing the bar and trying to do something different. And I think we're trying to find our voice. What is South African cinema? I mean, I can quite distinctly see Mexicans, like their voice, Mexican cinema. I think Australia even has a distinct voice where I can recognize beyond the accent, like just what kind of films your filmmakers make. And I'd love to see more of that coming through from South Africa.
Shane Vermouden and Brett Michael Innes. Tune in to next week's show to hear more about Brett's film Sync. That brings us to the end of this first part of our special program coming to you from the 2016 Cannes Film Festival. Digital borders are indeed a major concern for just about everyone here. Next week, we'll hear what Directors Fortnite artistic director Edouard Weintraub makes of shifting viewer habits. And I'll visit the European Commission's pavilion at the Village International to hear how digital borders are the new frontier for distribution challenges. Plus, why Japan and Iran are both keen to play a role in this year's event. And we'll talk to the Turkish production company behind a film shot in Syria. Today's show was edited by Nina Norek and researched by Yolene Goffin. I'm Ben Rylan. Don't forget to join us in Cannes again next week. For now, from the Palais du Festival, thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend.